Where Will We Work Now? The Future of Office, a Tangent original series. By now, odds are you've either worked from a co-working space, heard about them, or are listening from one right now. And today, over 3 million use co-working spaces worldwide. The way and where we work has changed forever. Remote, hybrid, flexible, it's a whole new world out there. Yet, face-to-face interaction is more needed than ever. In this new series, Jeffrey Berman, Zach Ahrens, and Edward Cohen will explore the future of the workplace and how office spaces are being reshaped. We'll take you on a journey to understand how the very nature of office buildings is evolving. How did we get here? And where are we heading? Join us as we explore the modern office and how prop tech founders, real estate owners and operators, and VC investors are reimagining its role across cities. Because in real life, and in office, will always be where innovation meets collaboration.
Hi, welcome to Tangent. I'm Edward Cohen. Today on Tangent, we have Zach Ahrens. Hi, Zach.
Good to see you, Edward. Always a pleasure.
Today on Tangent, we have Christelle Rojot, CEO at Coty, a flexible workplace solution designed for the way people work today. Coty offers turnkey private office spaces in urban locations with the most flexible terms on the market. Hi, Christelle. Where does this podcast find you?
Hi, Edward. Hi, Zach. It's great to be here. You find me in San Francisco.
So, Christelle, you and Coty are on a mission to empower companies to thrive and employees to love their work lives. Someone who isn't loving their work life right now are a lot of the office owners and operators out there trying to figure out what to make of their buildings, how to use them going forward, if to use them as office at all. So curious, you know, since you're at the forefront here of office innovation with Coty and Zach, also with your LPs and industry insiders, how are office owners and operators navigating the current environment, which I imagine a lot of them are in talks with lenders in terms of how to recapitalize or reposition their assets? We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Happy to kick it off. So I think there are two different types of spaces in terms of size, at least that's what we're seeing at Coty. Spaces below 5,000 square feet, I think, are in high demand. Companies as a whole has downsized in terms of like how much space they need, but they still very, very much need space, right? There are only 10 to 15% of employees that are fully remote at this point. 75% work hybrid. There's a need for space, but a lot less space than before because people come twice, 3 days a week and they're more distributed. So in terms of square footage, we really see a much higher demand for 1,000 to 6,000, 5,000 square feet, a lot less for anything outside of that. And so for owners that have really massive floor plates, we're seeing or need to convert them more into like an offsite type of space for an event space. A lot of like the fully remote companies or those that have thousands of employees across the US or across the world, they fly people in and they conduct like offsites a lot more often. And so last year we opened a new product called Coty Offsite to help those landlords monetize their space.
Interesting. And we're going to dive into the full Coty offering and how you came up with Coty in a second. Zach.
Yeah. Office is definitely under pressure. I'm not the first person to say that. I heard from a credible source, a distinguished professor at Columbia University, where I also teach, that 45% of office loans are effectively underwater if the Fed does not come through with some sort of rate cut and those landlords are able to renegotiate and refinance those loans, and or, as you were suggesting, Edward, acquire a new infusion of mezz debt or equity capital. I think the good news is the pandemic taught us that the office as a usage asset is not going away. It is still desirable. The worst spaces with no amenities that are not well located are not desirable, and there's not much we can do to reposition them. Although I like what Christelle was saying. They can be repositioned either as event spaces potentially or more flex offerings. We haven't seen much successful conversion to residential or even hospitality. A lot of stuff has to fall into place for that to happen. So I think with respect to the office as an asset, it's still desirable to the office worker. Almost everybody I speak to wants to be in an office. They don't necessarily want to be in an office all day, 4 or 5 days a week, but they do crave the interaction that the office provides. I think part of the good news about the high interest rate climate and uncertainty surrounding office use is that we are unlikely to see the financing of new office construction for quite some time. And so what will that do eventually? It will eventually constrain office supply. We have right now an oversupply of office stock in this country, in the United States, and demand needs to catch up to the supply. Theoretically, as long as we have economic growth, employment growth, and company formation growth, all three of which continue to persist, sitting now toward the end of Q1 of 2024, we should have office demand that ultimately catches up with that supply. However, there are going to be some office assets that just need to get knocked down or completely repurposed. They are just not viable in the same cyclical way that we saw play out with retail. There are some interior malls that are just completely not viable, yet there are other interior malls. I just read Simon is reinvesting $400 million in a well-located old mall they own. It's the oldest mall in America because they view it as viable if they have a new tenant base, new amenity base. So retail is not dead. Office is not dead. It just needs to be reimagined, rearranged, and re-tenanted.
Interesting. I think you're referring to Simon's King of Prussia Mall, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I think not like I always follow the mantra of nothing is ever as good or as bad as it seems in the moment. I think with office, we've already crossed that, you know, that perception that it's the end of the office as we know it. And that's certainly not the case. I mean, there was always the argument of, I mean, certainly it's the best time to be a tenant, an occupier, an employee going to an office, because you probably will have a great position negotiating for space and you'll get as many concessions, tenant improvements that you weren't getting before. But this conversation also reminds me when we hosted Nick Ramito from VTS a few months ago, when he was predicting how there'll be basically a bifurcation in the market of the haves and have-nots, because, you know, we do have the buildings, the one Vanderbilt here in New York City, Hudson Yards, where they are premium Class A office space with subway access, with you know, desirable locations for lunch, modern amenities, where, you know, they are reaching high occupancy levels, whereas buildings in poorly located areas or designed for a different era, their space is designed for a different era, won't be seeing that anytime soon. Wanted to ask you guys, how true is it that a lot of the vacancy is spread out across a few buildings that are basically accumulating all these vacant space?
I would say in a few neighborhoods, in San Francisco, downtown, and SoMa. I mean, SoMa, I think, reached like 45% availability. So it's like 30-35% vacancy plus 10% availability through subleases. It's bouncing back recently. Downtown has bounced back faster than SoMa. SoMa has taken like a long time. But yeah, I would say these are the two areas. You know, I was trained as a city planner, and to me, it's always about like zoning. Like mixed use neighborhoods are going to bounce back much faster than a solo use neighborhood where you have only commercial or only residential. It's just not how humans live and work, right? Like you go to work and you go to sleep and you go eat. So if you can have those three different uses in the same neighborhood, it's going to thrive, right? And so SoMa and then downtown in San Francisco have a really high density of office space, a lot less about homes. And so I think that's one of the reasons why it took a long time to bounce back.
Yeah, and as a city planner, we certainly appreciate your macro perspective as well as at the building level. And I mean, I think the impact of these vacant office buildings that it's going to have on cities and communities around these business hubs will be felt for years to come, because we are seeing falling property tax revenue. And that's something that even people that love working remote or people that don't necessarily live in downtowns will also be impacted one way or another by cities just collecting less revenue from buildings.
Yeah. Cities are strained, right? They're trying to collect more revenue and fix the climate with a couple things. One, congestion pricing. Two, local law 97, just for New York's sake, right? Not talking about San Francisco. But those are two initiatives. And those run counter, theoretically, to the idea of physically bringing people back into Midtown, back to the financial district area, right? The central business district areas of Manhattan. So there's certainly issues there. What I see happening in the office market is that it's less about class. There are certain class B assets, including the office building where Metaprop is based. It's very well located. It has limited amenities, but the rent is reasonable and the owner's not overlevered. So it's actually that building, I think, is going to be fine. What worries me is a building that was built in the 1960s on 3rd Avenue corridor and 55th Street. Big floor plates, let's say a bunch of law firms and accounting firms took a floor, right? 30-year leases. When those leases turn, my employees, they don't want to be there. They don't necessarily want to be in the garment district where we are either, but they prefer the garment district to that location by leaps and bounds. And so who is there to take that space? Because you can't cut that space up and lease it to small players. It just doesn't work. Whereas my office building has always been small in terms of the unit sizes. So I think like we are going to see when all of those leases turn and the landlords are left with a building that used to be considered class A, but now is no longer amenitized, no longer particularly environmentally sustainable without a huge capital expenditure for retrofit, and it's not well situated. Those are the assets that I'm most nervous about. I think assets that have always been kind of considered less desirable in the office sector are potentially going to be in better shape than some of these class A buildings of 30, 40 years ago that are just no longer class A, but they're not class B either. And class B type tenants like us don't want to be there. And class A type tenants like the White Shoe Law Firm doesn't want to be there either, because they want to be in a brand new building. And to your point earlier, they can now negotiate hard. There's never been a time in the office market as a tenant where one can get better amenities, more well and sustainable work environment for a better rent deal. More TIs, more free rent, lower nominal rent, right? Than in this market right here.
Yep. Well said. And yeah, I mean, a building on 56th and 3rd Avenue in the city, I don't think there are enough embassies out there near the UN to want to use that space ever. We're going to have to create new countries.
In the heart of Silicon Valley, there's an organization making waves in helping solve the housing crisis, Housing Trust Silicon Valley. At Housing Trust, they provide developer financing, homeownership assistance, and lender and broker resources to help create more equitable and affordable communities. Established over 20 years ago by local businesses, community leaders, and affordable housing activists, Housing Trust Silicon Valley uses transformative housing finance and public and private partnerships to create a strong, affordable housing market. From those experiencing homelessness to developers, renters, and first-time homebuyers, Housing Trust SV is dedicated to ensuring that every neighbor has access to safe, stable, and affordable housing. Housing Trust SV is making a difference in the 14 counties of the Greater Bay Area and Sacramento. These are communities with a common need: more affordable housing and the capital to support its development. Join the Housing Trust SV in making a lasting impact on our communities. Housing Trust Silicon Valley, where innovation meets compassion. Learn more at housingtrustsv.org.
Christelle, flex space, co-working. So co-working has become a crucial component of the office market, the office experience, the office offering. And we saw, you know, since the 80s and 90s, we had Regus and then WeWork and the others. But what's wrong with traditional co-working models? We know they had these inherent misalignments between having to sign long-term lease commitments while having to sublease space on a month-to-month or short-term basis. So we'd love to hear from, you know, what issues you saw with traditional co-working and then how is Cody solving them?
Yeah, I think there are two angles, right? Like there's the landlord angle and then there's the customer, the tenant angle. I think co-working did innovate on the customer side because there's never been easier to have access to an office space immediately. Like tomorrow you can go and start and have your office in a WeWork or in a Regus. That was like a revolution, right, in real estate. The difficulty though is that once you hit 5 to 10 employees, like you graduate from co-working, you need more privacy, you want to build your own culture, co-working starts to be really distracting. And so typically then companies are ready to graduate and invest in having their own space. So co-working, like as much as it's great for a certain size of teams or individual remote workers or individual freelancers, independent workers, I don't think it fits the needs of larger companies. As soon as they hit 5 to 10 employees in that location, they need their own space. And then on the landlord side is a lot of issues, right? As we know, it's been proven over and over again with different companies who failed in their business model. It was basically a bet back in 2010 that rents would only go up, right? So they would lock themselves, the co-working providers, into a 10-20-year lease at a flat base rent at the 2010 rates or 2015 rates. And that's it. And then so it's a race to occupancy. So like there's a mismatch between the terms between them and the landlord and them and the customer, but it's a massive mismatch. It's like 20 years compared to like monthly. So first you have the risk of occupancy. As soon as like they're not hitting a minimum threshold, they're losing money. The landlord is not, it's the co-working provider that is. And that, so like the risk is completely imbalanced. And then like that bet on office rents are only going to go up, which is not the case. And the past couple of years have really shown that like it actually dropped. I think in the last year, it dropped by 25% in San Francisco and 15% or 10% in Manhattan. So it's definitely not going up. It's going down, and that's okay, you know, but it's just like that model is not adjusting to the market. And that's why I'm very bullish about the marketplace model that actually can adapt to the market conditions.
Hmm. Interesting. So tell us more about this marketplace model. How did you came up with Cody, and how are you now helping owners, office owners and managers use space more efficiently and also helping customers, office users basically love their work again, love going to the office again?
Yeah. So I think like, you know, the office fundamentally has changed. And the 9-to-5 office log and the 10-year lease is gone. That's ancient history. The new office has to be easy, hybrid friendly, flexible. And so that's what we want to offer to companies out there, right? The easiest way of getting office space that actually grows with you and not the other way around. So we built an office as a service platform. We manage marketplace. We help companies find a fully, you know, a private standalone office that is going to be serviced through our platform at the most flexible terms on the market. And then once they match with that space, our platform like streamlines the whole end-to-end process from leasing to rent payments to like the cleaning, the internet, the furniture. It's completely streamlined. So for landlords, for them initially, we kind of have a marketing tool, right? They can promote their space that's sitting empty. We turn the vacant offices into a higher quality product. We're just talking about Class A, Class B. Any vacant office that's well located, obviously, like, can be a very appealing product for tenants out there, my huge belief is that it needs to be easy, it needs to be flexible. So a turnkey flexible office space is appealing in this market. And so that we help those landlords package their space that way for Cody. And then we give them access to a pool of tenants who want that product. And they can find their properties for the marketplace. Another value for landlords, you know, landlords are not operators, typically. Only the really big landlords can like invest in having all these amenities and include like a fully serviced building. And these are appealing, right? So we kind of bring that value to all the rest of commercial real estate that does not have the bandwidth or the tools to actually deliver a higher quality product for their tenants. And so Cody handles through the platform, like the marketing, the legal, the rent payments, and then streamlines servicing the space for the tenants.
Such a headache, the last point that you mentioned for tenants, especially the, you know, not big teams that having, you know, being able to outsource all those tasks to you sounds like a great value. And also in terms of the approach to like hospitality within office, I mean, reminds me of the conversation we had here on Tangent with Ryan Simonetti from Convene, and how it's where we're going in terms of office space and the experience and people wanting to go to a Cody and not just SL Green building, because they feel like they're part of it, part of the community, right? Part of this space that understands their needs and enables them to excel at their jobs and connect with others. Now, in terms of, so for real estate owners listening, you know, what type of buildings are ideal to partner with Cody? You mentioned well-located, naturally, you know, they have to be in desirable locations with access to transportation, density. But yeah, what type of buildings, what type of spaces are primed to partner with Cody?
We're seeing a lot of demand for 3,000 square feet spaces. That's like our bread and butter. It ranges from 1,000 all the way to 5,000, but 3,000 is really like the ideal size. It basically is 10 to 20 people working there on a daily basis. Class B building is like, I think 80% of our landlords are Class B. They're much more likely to offer better rents for tenants out there than Class A. And so we like them because we can match them really fast with companies. Yeah, that's what I would say. And then in terms of location, I think like we are a demand-driven marketplace, so you actually can't see our supply until you tell us what you want, because we want to collect all that data and understand exactly what's the right size, neighborhood, and budget that companies have out there for office space. And that informs which type of buildings or landlords we want to bring on board.
Interesting. And how do you structure your agreements with managers? Like, are these management deals? It's a managed marketplace, but yeah, in terms of like the matching process between landlord and occupier, tell us more.
Yeah, we have license agreements with our landlords, and so revenue share agreement of partnership. And so the landlord like earned the rent, and on the customer side, it's an all-in-one membership with Cody, and we are the sole point of contact. So they're sheltered from the building and the different vendors and the landlord, and like we take care of that through the platform. And for the customer, it's a one-line item. Basically, all their office expenditures is into one price, which VP of finance and CFOs love, typically. Yeah, that's why how it works.
Very cool. In terms of, so the first time I got acquainted with Cody, I was actually walking next to the first ever WeWork here in New York City on Grand Street. And I saw a sign that says, "We won't." Can you tell us more about this sensational marketing campaign, provocative campaign that proved to be successful at a time when WeWork was filing for bankruptcy and restructuring their company? What were your thoughts behind it? What were some of the results? And yeah, it was certainly provocative and certainly successful.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, our goal is to, you know, help founders and companies out there that will lose their office, right? And as a founder, like, we're not going to waste time, or we're just going to go right there where they are. And and it worked. It started actually back in August because, you know, WeWork earnings were public, right? Because they did a SPAC. So like every quarter you would see their financials. And I was blown away because in August, like, it was very clear they had less than a quarter of cash left, 1 to 2 quarters, not even counting debts, like just like cash. And there was not a lot of buzz around it in the press in August. And so we started to do our campaigns late August because we started to have, they started to shut down actually buildings in August, a lot more than post-bankruptcy. It's like between August and November, they shut down a ton of buildings. And so we started to have inquiries from customers who were either losing their office space or through WeWork, or their WeWorks were becoming really packed because they would shut down a building and relocate you to the next building, right? That is more profitable. But then it's chaos. Like, it's extremely distracting. Like, you're packing even more people in the same, on the same floor, fighting for the same phone booth and conference room. You start to be really negative experience. And so we had that input, like that inbound from those customers. And we thought like we should just go all in and do like a marketing campaign. So shout out to my head of marketing for finding WeWant, because I thought it was brilliant. And he created a lot of buzz. And so we did like our first campaign late August. We did another one mid-October, right before they filed for bankruptcy. They actually sent us a cease and desist letter 2 weeks before filing for bankruptcy. Not sure why they even put the time to do that, but you know, it was a journey.
We certainly welcome fun, provocative banter campaigns in the real estate world. And I mean, they have bigger fish to fry than sending a cease and desist?
It's a shame the community adjusted EBITDA wasn't just a little bit higher, and they didn't run their cash. So.
So if you guys didn't see the campaign said office shutting down, ? We won't. So yeah, I mean, you were just catering to the community. Just thinking about back in the day, Adam Newman pulling in, I think it was Jamie Hodari from Industrious, and like basically offering a hostile acquisition of sorts of their company. I mean, they set the stage. They laid the groundwork for this type of, you know. I think we also had a defunct competitor, Knotel, poaching tenants.
Knotel had the bus. They would drive the bus in front of the WeWorks. Yeah, that's how they would get in the early Knotel days. Yeah, I think all is fair in love and real estate. And, you know, it's I applaud you for what was clearly an effective marketing campaign. And yeah, I think 2 weeks before bankruptcy, they should probably be worrying about other issues in the legal department. But
who are we to say?
Yeah. But yeah, who are we to judge? Yeah, who are we to judge
who
that?
Who are we to judge? But no, I think it's what you said earlier about office location is crucial in terms of, I think I read that studies on job satisfaction show that commutes that are over 20, 30 minutes basically means you'll end up disliking your job sooner rather than later. And walking to work, for example, in New York City or even San Francisco, I think it's the ultimate perk, the ultimate amenity, if you can have that.
Full disclosure, I am a WeWork shareholder, but it was through acquisition. I didn't buy any WeWork shares on my own volition. But I wanted to disclose it because we're talking about it. We're on a podcast that's going to be distributed to our millions of fans. And so I need to disclose it.
Full disclosure, we are transparent here. Christelle, I have a question.
I'm a Cody shareholder.
There you go. Yeah. Love it. I hope so. Hope it's a good one.
We should have a full disclosure segment here. Christelle, a question that has been bugging me since I was born. Why can't native French speakers pronounce the word idea?
Okay. I'll try. Idea.
Wow. That is greater than the French Revolution. That's pretty good. I was joking yesterday with a friend, and I remember also my French roommate. It was ID. Anyway, just a funny one. But French speakers are...
issues. Your friend is having immigration issues.
Definitely. He's not getting his green card. Christelle, collaboration superpower. If you could choose one person, historic or living, to do a partnership with, who would it be?
I read the question this morning. I thought about it. I forgot about it. My heart goes always to Airbnb because I'm a huge fan. I'm not sure it's the best partnership for Cody specifically, because like Cody's for work, Airbnb's for traveling. But yeah, just because I'm a huge fan of Ryan Chesky and Airbnb and what they've been able to achieve. Like, I would find ways to do a partnership with Airbnb. That would be fantastic.
We are fans of Brian Chesky here on the pod. I mean, you're both marketplaces. And also, to be completely honest, that we won't campaign. The first thing that came to mind, even though they're somewhat different, was the famous Airbnb serial U.S. election campaign that they did back in the day to raise funds, where they
sold Obama O's
mm-hmm. and McCain Mavericks cereals. Anyway, they sold out, I don't know, $30,000, $40,000 of cereal. And that's how they were able to fund some of their operations. And that's the sort of, outside the box, outside the cereal box creativity of WeWalt. So that's a great answer.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia, and they were at RISD when I was at Brown. And Joe Gebbia's business before Airbnb, at RISD, you have to sit on the floor a lot. You're in these artist studio sessions, workshops, and he was sitting on the floor for like 5 hours a day. So his business was this butt pad that you would like put in your backpack and bring to your thing, and you would sit on this pad, and he sold those around Providence. So that should show you to keep, if you're an entrepreneur, just keep at it, because you may have, the butt pads first and Airbnb's your second. Adam Newman continues to do it, right? Remember, his first business was knee pads for babies. Second business, which didn't work. Second business, WeWork, didn't work, although worked out financially very well for him. We'll see how he does with this third one. But interesting that Gebbia and Newman both had pad-related businesses before Airbnb and WeWork, respectively. I don't know whether, what to read into that. Can I give you my collab? I've been thinking, Edward, a lot about my collaboration superpower.
Yes, the pad conspiracy. We have to dive into that. And I mean,
let's have them both on the pod and see what we can, have Adam and Joe.
And I just want to talk about their first ideas. That's a great focus on content. Just, first failed ideas of famous entrepreneurs. Anyway, Zach, who is your collaboration superpower this week?
So I got to go with Conchita Martinez.
Oof.
Because, as you know, I've been only naming tennis coaches recently for collaboration superpower, because my dream is to become a tennis coach. Conchita Martinez was not only an incredible player coming out of her native Spain, winning Wimbledon, making it to number two in the world, but she then captained Spain to Davis Cup titles and started to coach many big deal players on the WTA tour, including the Venezuelan Gabriela Muguruza to two Grand Slam titles, and I think number one or number two. So I'm going to go with Conchita Martinez, probably the best coach on the WTA tour right now. And I remember growing up watching her matches. I remember her playing, the other Spanish greats like Arantxa Sánchez Vicario, some of the South American greats like Gabriela Sabatini, and then obviously our local greats like, Monica Seles.
I love that.
Yeah, she's from Yugoslavia. But
with Cristel here, we have to mention Amélie Mauresmo.
Amélie, of course, yeah.
Please.
And there's been Monfils made a run at Indian Wells. He got knocked out, but he did okay.
Yeah, the biggest tragedy of France is that we were not able to get a player in the top three or top five. I think we had a top five like back in 2015.
Grosjean.
2012.
I trained next to Sebastian Grosjean. He was living in Florida in Boca Raton. Actually used the hat like you're wearing it right now. He was wearing, Zach, the hat Grosjean, nice. Right? He has the backwards hat.
I was thinking of Wilfried Tsonga. Tsonga was, I think, the best ranked French player in tennis recently, in 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, Joe Wilfried. Big fans of Joe Wilfried as well. I mean, Yannick Noah, the son of
the father,
yeah, that's right.
He was a and then he became like a reggae star, right? I mean, he's like a legend in
France. Yeah. He's much more famous for his singing than
music,
his tennis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. I mean, I was a fan of Richard Gasquet, but he was famous for other reasons.
I grew up watching Guy Forget Do you remember Guy Forget? And then it was Cedric Pioline. Those are the
Yeah,
French
Violin.
guitars back, yeah, in the old days, yeah.
Anyway, that was the longest tangent in a while. Christelle, where can Tangent listeners learn more about Cody and connect with you?
Yeah, connect with me on LinkedIn or over email, christelle@cody.com, and they can learn more about Cody on cody.com.
Christelle Rojo, CEO at Cody, turnkey private office spaces in urban locations with the most flexible terms on the market. Thank you so much for coming to Tangent today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Where Will We Work Now? The Future of Office, a Tangent original series. Don't forget to follow, rate, and review us, and share the show with a friend. This series is produced by Edward Cohen. If you'd like your company or organization to be featured across Tangent's community, you can email us at tangentcommunity@gmail.com. And remember, collaboration is our superpower. So stay curious and always be learning.